What is nothing?
Now that's deep.
What in the fuck are we doing here?
Free socks. What is something?
That's deep, bro. Welcome to That's Deep, Bro. Serious questions with silly people. I am your host, Christina Pajitsky. And let's get the show started. I want to thank my sponsors for this show. I'm absolutely thrilled to bring you the great courses. Listen, man, learning doesn't stop after we leave school. There's so much to know. There's so much to be curious about in this huge, huge world. And I know you agree with me because you listen to That's Deep, Bro. And that's the reason I love The Great Courses. The Great Courses offers engaging video and audio lectures taught by top professors and experts. And I recently listened to The Great Courses lecture series, The Philosopher's Toolkit, How to Be the Most Rational Person in Any Room, taught by award-winning professor Patrick Grimm. And I got to tell you, what's great about that is if you want to win an argument against your spouse, let's say, or your boss, or anybody, it's a great lecture series to teach you how to do that and to really learn why people are full of it, okay? Because they pull out these arguments and they make no sense. And the Philosopher's Toolkit will help you defeat your enemies, which is really what I stand for most, I think, right? Anyway, I learned a lot from this course, from The Great Courses, and want you to check it out too. The Great Courses, celebrating their 25th anniversary, has over 500 courses on many topics, including history, science, photography. I mean, you can even learn about investing. You can learn about art history, which is something I wish I would have studied in school, and I'm going to do it on The Great Courses. You can watch or listen with DVDs, CDs, streaming, digital downloads, or with the Great Courses apps. How cool is that? And for a limited time, the Great Courses has a special offer for my listeners. That's right. Just for you, you can order from 8 of their best-selling courses, including the Philosopher's Toolkit, at up to 80% off the original price. That's crazy. 80% off. But this offer is only available for a limited time. So order today. Go to thegreatcourses.com/bro. That's thegreatcourses.com/bro. B-R-O, bro. I bet you The Great Courses never thought in a million years they'd have to put a promo code like that on their product. But I'm so glad they did. It's so good. It's so good. You can learn about anything. Isn't that better than sitting in traffic? Like, I love to listen to them when I'm in traffic. You know, why listen to stuff that rots your brain? You may as well learn some, right? Also, I would like to thank Sattva Mattress Company for sponsoring this show. If you listen to Your Mom's House, you know that Tom and I, my husband and I, are huge fans of Sattva. We ordered their mattress long before they were sponsors of Your Mom's House and now of That's Deep, Bro. And we found it to be such a great customer service experience. I mean, I know it sounds dicey to order a bed online, but it really isn't. Because when you think about it, you go to some store, you know, you sit on a bed for 5 whole seconds before some nightmare of a sales clerk comes over and starts harassing you. And then you don't really get a sense for what you're going to buy anyways. So at least with Sattva Mattress, you get a 75-day trial. That's 75 days. That's a long time. And if you don't like it, you send it back. And it's a great deal, man. You can get a mattress comparable to specs retail stores. Let's say you get a $2,000 mattress in like a regular place. The Sattva mattress is $899. We got a king-size mattress from Sattva for pennies, bro. I mean it, and it's so good. The quality of this bed is ridiculous. You've got individually wrapped comfort coils, a dual parameter edge support system. I'm not even sure what it is. All I know is that it feels amazing, and it doesn't smell. You know, you get these beds that they show up to your house, and they smell like disgusting plastic. That's the first thing I noticed about our Sattva bed, is it doesn't reek of some weird chemical. Like, it's just cotton. It's like organic cotton. I believe it's made in the USA, which is great. So anyways, go to saatvamattress.com. That's S-A-A-T-V-A mattress.com. S-A-A-T-V-A mattress.com. And change your life. Get your life. Change your life. Great. I'm so excited to talk to you guys. I have so much to get to. I've been holding secrets from you people, and I am sick and tired. I am sick and tired of hiding in the shadows. I've got a major announcement, and you know, this has been a good episode for me to get off my chest. This has been brewing for a long time, bros. So I'm so happy to finally share a bunch of crap I got going on with you. Okay, let's get started. Okay, I love this song. Let's start with this song. This is a cute one.
Bing bong, bing bing bong bong, bing bong, bing bing bong bing bong. Bing bong, bing bing bong bong, bing bong, bing bing bong bing bing. É só isso, meu baião, e não tem mais nada, não. O meu coração pediu assim, só. Bing bong, bing bing bong bong, bing bong, bing bing bong
bing bong. It's not a cute song. I love it. I love Bossa Nova. I listen to this crap all the time. I'm telling you, if you're in a bad mood, you got to put on some Bossa Nova music from Brazil. Brazil. Listen to this. Listen to the language. Like, what? Of course, she stopped singing the minute I want you guys to hear it. And this is Astrud Gilberto. And they speak this language. It's so beautiful. I don't know what the hell they're singing about. I love every single song. I think it's just love, right? Isn't that what everybody sings about? Most people. Except for today. It's not so much love. It's like, bitch, I want to fuck you. I'm going to stick it in your ass. Of course. Now look, no more singing. Anyway, if you want to live longer, listen to Bossa Nova music from the 60s from Brazil, because it'll make you so happy. Anyways, bros. I am so excited to finally sit down and tell you what's going on with me. I've been harboring a secret for so long, and it's been killing me. It's been killing me. I'm winded even talking about it. I'm so excited. So I'll just tell you, I am pregnant. What? I know. Crazy, right? Me, I'm pregnant. And I've been pregnant for it's my 15th week, and it's been so hard to not tell people. It's the worst. I don't know how do you keep the secret? I mean, I had to keep it for so long because I'm old. I just turned 39 last week. And, you know, in baby making years, they call me, that's quote, advanced maternal age. I get the riot act every time I would go to my doctor when I was trying to conceive about how old my eggs are. You want to feel bad about yourself? Try to conceive a child over the age of 35, because they love to remind you how absolutely ancient your eggs are. And I'll get to that in a minute. I'm 15 weeks pregnant, and I'm so excited. My husband and I are having a boy, and it's been such a journey to get here. Such a journey. But we're thrilled. I'm over the moon. I feel great now. The first trimester, as is famously known for being, it was a little rough. I never puked. I wanted to puke. And I think it's funny, if you listen to past episodes, start listening to That's Deep Bro around, the first week of April-ish. Wait, was that when I found out I was pregnant? Yeah, like April. And I think you can notice the topics getting depressing. I was like, let's do isolation. Let's do shame. Let's do depression. Let's do never leaving your house. I think because I was physically so ill. And, you know how it is when you're sick. You can't even imagine that you will ever be a person again. And I'm so thankful to finally be in my second trimester. Now I can announce it to the world. And I'm also resurrected, man. I'm also back to being a human being. I can't even imagine what I sounded like the last few months. I was probably super depressed. You guys are probably like, what is wrong with her? What is she going through? But I'm back. Oh my God, I'm back. And I'm feeling great. Baby's doing great as far as I know. I wish I could look in there every day, but I can't. I bought this Doppler radar. Is that what it's called? Doppler sound machine thing you can get on Amazon. Which, by the way, if you do your shopping on Amazon, please go through my banner. That's zebrapodcast.com, as I did when I bought my Doppler sound. It's like, I don't know, $50, and you can squish it on your belly and hear your baby's heartbeat, theoretically. Although I feel like I'm just listening to mine. I don't know what is going on with that stuff, but whatever. It gives me peace of mind. But yeah, dudes, bros, it's been quite a road to get here. As I said, I'm 39, which I may as well be dead in reproductive years. I mean, I live in LA, and a lot of old broads like me start to think about children at this age too. So thankfully, I wasn't some kind of anomaly. But boy, oh boy. So what happened was we started a while back. What was I? 36 or something. And, you know, problems, not easy. It wasn't that easy for me to get preggers. So we went to a fertility doctor. And my favorite is sitting across from this guy. And what happens usually is when, for some reason, I don't know why this happens with human beings, but when people find out you're a comedian for a living, they tend to want to joke it up with you, even when the moment is really inappropriate. And we saw this doctor, like Beverly Hills, total fertility doc. And, you know, you have to write on your forms what you do for a living. And, of course, I told the truth. We shouldn't have. Both my husband and I are comedians. And it was like a shucky ducky fest during my, like, fertility consultation, which is kind of serious and potentially a bummer. You know, you don't know if you can have children at that point. And this guy is just like trying to make everything super funny, and it's not, telling bad pun jokes. And here's a surprising fact, if you didn't know this, I don't want to make anybody panic, but I thought for sure that the years of LSD, pot, drinking, Coke, any kind of drug use that I had done since the time I started at 14, actually 13, I was convinced that all that drug use would affect my fertility. Turns out, they say it's not. They say, this doctor told me that what affects your fertility most is, are you ready? You're going to shit your pants. Coffee and cigarettes. How dumb is that? Caffeine and cigarettes ruin your fertility, at least for women, for your egg quality. And I was like, get the fuck out of here. You got to be joking. What about all those DARE programs I sat through in school? Remember the drug abuse resistance education in the 80s? Which really just taught you which drugs you wanted to do. Because it was like, oh, here's all the drugs. Here's what they do. I bet you guys can't wait to get into high school to start trying them. But yeah, so there you go. Coffee and cigarettes ruin drug quality more than anything else, than the LSD I did. So all that stuff was a lie, man. But anyways, I'm here, and I think it's going to be okay. My belly's finally popped. I mean, I always had a gut, but now there's something under it, which is, it's kind of exciting. It's kind of cool. I really am. I'm a mix of emotions, people, and what I've noticed about maternity in America, in this country, is that it's weird because, like, you got to do it perfectly. You know, I feel a lot of pressure. There's just a lot of pressure. I feel like there's a lot of pressure to be the perfect mom. Even though I'm not a mother really yet, there's a lot of, like, peer pressure from other women that have had kids, from these apps that I've been told, you gotta get the What to Expect app, you gotta get the app, the bump app, you gotta get the apps, and they tell you what's going on every day. And It's so restrictive. Being pregnant in America is fraught with potential disasters around every corner, and I think it's and by that I mean, you know, I get these like updates from these apps that I belong to. They tell you how your kid's doing every day, and like, it's so stupid. Like, 10 foods to avoid. It's like, yeah, I get it. There's a million things I can't eat right now, and I feel like I'm constantly reminded of Listeria every 2 seconds, which is what's in hot dogs and cold cuts, which sucks because I absolutely love processed meats. This is one of the saddest times of my life. I love sushi and I love processed. Apparently, I'm a very risky eater. Everything I love, I'm not allowed to touch for the next, 5 months now? Such a bummer. Oh, no, and then I have to breastfeed, so there you go. Oh, and then there's the pressure to breastfeed, and I think it's really just due to the over-commodification of everything in this country. I mean, like, I'm fucking looking at these strollers now for kids, and I remember the stroller that my parents pushed me around in. You know, we went to Europe when I was, like, 2, like, to Switzerland and Hungary. And, I mean, there's pictures of them pushing me around in a stroller that's just, like, 2 sticks and then a hammock in between it. That's what we sat in the 70s. I was born in 76. That's what I sat in. Car seats? You better get y'all life. Ain't no such thing as a car seat. I don't even remember having one. I didn't use a seatbelt until it was mandatory in California, I believe, in 1988. I didn't even buckle up, man. I remember being in a car wreck with my mother in our little Toyota Camry or whatever the hell that car was. A Corolla. And you just slid around, bro. I mean, do you remember that? Are you a child of the 70s or the 80s when you guys would just sit in the back of station wagons? My husband was telling me he and his siblings would just sit in the back of the station wagon, like facing oncoming traffic. That's what we did. And if someone rear-ended you, you just died. You just died. Your kids died. A lot of precautions to be taking now with children. There's a lot of fear. And mostly my biggest fear is, well, A, becoming my mother, and B, becoming one of the mothers I see around me in the burbs. There's a lot of, in my opinion, a lot of over-parenting apparently happening. There's a lot of over-scheduling I feel is happening with kids. And, you know, I don't know. I'm going to have to navigate all that stuff when I get there. But I just, you know, I was in the airport yesterday and I see women doing this. It was like a lady with her kid in line to get on the airplane. And I see parents doing this where they have to narrate every moment of what's happening in the child's reality all the time. Like, okay, Shelly, and then they're going to rip the ticket up and then you're going to walk down the... You're going to walk down there and then you're going to put your bag under the seat, but you're going to push the seat. Okay, Shelly, let's go. Good job. Good job. Here we go. Okay, now you're walking. Like this constant narration of what the kid's doing. It's like, lady, shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up. Give this kid a moment to process what's happening in their lives on their own. Does that even happen anymore? Because I see it a lot. I see it with people, unfortunately, I'm related to who have children. Or friends were like, come on, take a picture, smile, give so-and-so a hug, give them a kiss. They're like, Jesus Christ, just shut the fuck up. Let this kid have a minute. Just 1 minute. 1 minute of peace and quiet. You know, I feel like I had a lot of peace and quiet. But, you know, whatever. My parents, listen, we all know my parents were animals. But at least they raised me a little more calmly. Maybe that's a European thing. I don't know. But I ain't doing it. I ain't overscheduling, and I ain't narrating everything my kid's doing. No fucking way. No way. Makes it neurotic. Here's my favorite from one of my pregnancy apps, What to Expect. It's the best, dude. It's the best. Okay, so here's one. This is an actual article. They send you, like, email updates every day. It's so stupid. Here's one that goes, what to do if you get hungry? I'm not even kidding. What to do if you get hungry. And I had to click on it because I'm like, I don't know. I can't figure it out. What do I do? And it's like, you got to eat. You got to eat if you're hungry and you're pregnant because you're eating for two. Like that whole, if you're hungry, your baby's hungry. And there's a lot of guilt associated with how to eat. You got to eat 5,000 servings of kale and vegetables, 10,000 servings of fruits. Oh, yeah. And what to do if you're hungry. And my favorite, too, I'm on these message boards, these mommy message boards, mostly to judge other women, because that's really what all that's really about. I mean, does anybody really contribute positively to these, like, message? Maybe you do. You're a better person than me if you do. I usually just judge. There's one person in particular I follow on one of these pregnancy apps, because she's particularly neurotic, which I relate to, because when you're pregnant, it's like every feeling is, you know, oh, this is it. This kid's gonna, you know, end up with five heads, and you're totally panicked a lot of time. But this woman wrote, I swear to God, she goes, it starts off with, I'm a bad person. That's what she writes. That's the first, I'm a bad person. And in my head, I'm like, oh, this is going to be awesome. Like, what did she do today? Did she like stab her husband because she has a hormonal rate, like outrage? What is it? I'm a bad person. Today, I ate at Arby's. I'm like, you got that right. What are you, white trash? What are you, a hobo? Who the hell eats at Arby's? First of all, it's disgusting. Arby's is like, it's lower than like White Castle, isn't it? It's like worse than eating shrimp nibblers. Arby's. It's just that disgusting, what is it, roast beef? They look like vagina lips in a bun. And it's so gross. I hear the curly fries are great, but can't you go somewhere civilized? Like Jack in the Box for your curly fries? Arby's. Get your life, Arby's. Anyway, she's a bad person because she had fast food and she was pregnant, which is funny because I've been hitting the In-N-Out 2 or 3 times a week during this pregnancy, and I don't feel one iota bad about it. Okay. My father, when we told him I was pregnant, and wants me to name the kid his name. He's trying to sell me on Arthur as being the best name for a son, which is really, really funny. yeah. Anyways, it's been cool, man. I read this wacky thing. Let's get into some philosophy. I read this wacky thing in a book called A Spiritual Pregnancy, because I was like, I can't take this. What? First of all, I'm reading the What to Expect When You're Expecting book, which is like the Bible on procreation and pregnancy. And this book gives me so much anxiety and so much, it's written so stupidly. It's full of bad puns and panic information. And I feel like it's unnecessarily overly cautious about stuff. You're like, dude, you got, listen. I know there's a 0.0009 chance of this piece of baloney poisoning my unborn. You know, there are women have been carrying babies since the dawn of time. I'm pretty sure they didn't have this book to help them navigate the treacherous waters of pregnancy. So I get these videos every week from the What to Expect app. I'm going to play one for you. There's this horrible woman who like hosts them, and she's got a red shirt with a black bra that's see-through, and it's really distracting because all I do is look at her bra, and she's older, so it's not like sexy or nothing, but she's an older lady, and her lip gloss is so shiny. And it's just full of puns and like, let's just. Oh, God. Here we go.
Ladies and gentlemen, mommies and daddies, in this corner, weighing it at a whopping third of an ounce and standing, or rather laying, 2 inches long, is your baby.
Oh, boy.
She's caterpillar size right now, though not quite as fuzzy, and certainly more human in appearance. Sure, her forehead is still high, and her head is still disproportionately larger than her body, but her facial bones are completely formed.
Sure, your kid's an alien.
She has an obvious jawline, and most of her soon-to-be adorable facial features are well-defined.
Okay, lady.
The ears are now sculpted into their seashell shape. Hair follicles are sprouting head to toe.
Come on,
nipples
lady.
Nipples on the chest are
Give
visible.
Us some more puns.
Fingernail and toenail beds are developing. Her skin is beginning to thicken, and those diminutive digits are
Please.
No longer webbed like
With
a frontlet.
With the lip gloss.
And behind those little lips, your baby is trying out her new tongue and palate. Yawning, swallowing, chewing. All right. Prepping for hours
okay,
of eating
I can't
and chatting
take her
in
anymore.
Year six.
I can't take her anymore. I absolutely can't take this woman anymore. It's killing me. And I want to know what's happening to my kid every week. But I have to look at her and I have to hear her. Mommies and dads. Oh, God. Anyway, she's killing my soul. This woman. I mean, I wish they had different hosts, you know, because if you don't like one, then there's another one. But she does it every fucking week, man. It kills my soul. Anyways, let's get on to the philosophy, somewhat-ish. Okay, so I'm reading A Spiritual Pregnancy, which is like wacky, hippy-dippy book I bought on my Nook, A Spiritual Pregnancy. And it's really hard to read because it's like, you know, a lot of talking to your baby and talking to your chakra, your root chakra. But I did find one thing really interesting. It says that a pregnancy is a time when a woman is walking in between two worlds, essentially the godly world, the God, and between the human world. We're kind of this cool interlude between the spiritual realm and the human realm because we're bringing a life into existence. And I think that's kind of kooky, right? That's kind of neat. It's a nice way to look at it when your boobs hurt and you can't take a dump because you're backed up. What's really interesting, I think philosophically anyways, with being pregnant is I have a penis growing inside of me, which is really weird. But it also forces you, the mom, the person carrying this thing, to become comfortable with change. Pregnancy is an ongoing roller coaster of symptoms, of anxieties, of ambivalence, of sometimes terror, sometimes elation. It really is a roller coaster. From getting pregnant to finally being pregnant to hoping that everything's okay with this kid. You know, I'm only week 15. I'm nowhere near being totally out of the woods here. But what's really been interesting to me as a conscious person is to roll with change, which is something I've never really been fond of doing until now. Because every day feels different and you do have to go, hey, guess what? I'm not going to do that today. I can't do that show. I can't, whatever it is you want me to do. I can't do it today, bro. I got to lay down. And it's really helped me reprioritize my life. I don't do nearly all the crap I used to do. And I mean, now looking back, I go, wow, I really did a lot of stuff that A, I didn't want to do. And B, I didn't necessarily have to do. You know, you get into these patterns as human beings, we get into ruts and patterns of thinking that I must do this, I have to do this, or will happen. I catastrophize. I shouldn't say you. You don't. I don't know if you do that, but I catastrophize constantly. If I don't, you know, if I don't answer this phone call right away, this bad thing will happen. If I don't do this thing this person wants me to do immediately, these bad things will happen. And I've found through being forced to be. To reprioritize because my body will just shut down. Like when you're pregnant, there's no, sometimes you're so tired. All you can do is sleep. You must sleep. There's no other thing you can do right now, but lay down. It really forces you when you have a finite amount of energy, you really start to go, wow, I really don't have forever to live on this planet. I really don't have, an infinite amount of time or resources or energy or health. And I really have been thinking a lot these days about reprioritizing. I say no to things that I never did before and I've always wanted to. I said no yesterday to somebody and it felt fantastic. I said no to somebody that wanted me to do their podcast. And I had just finished performing 6 hours of stand-up that week. I was really tired. I physically was like, I can't, I know. And I just said no. When's the last time you said no? you know, you don't have to say yes to stuff, but you must say no kindly. And I try to be kind about my no's, but it really is exciting to say no to people. I didn't know how much I would enjoy it. And it really opens up other doors to you too when you have to reprioritize. It's like I'm obviously pulling back on the road dates that I will be doing. Because, hey, guess what? Doing stand-up on the road, big pregnant lady, it's not really fun. Doesn't feel good to fly. It doesn't feel good to live in a hotel for 5 days. If I do it, it's going to be more like one-nightery, one or two nights out, and then come home. Which makes sense, right? Come on. Come on. Who wants to live in a hotel? It's the worst. But in doing so, and telling my agents that, lots of other doors have opened up. Lots of other opportunities come. And I think that's really neat when you say no to shit that you really don't want. Other things happen. Which brings me to this thought that I had this week as well. How many things... I had this thing happen to me this week where I've been doing something a certain way for years. Just doing it the same way because I was convinced that this is the only way to do this thing, right? This is the only way. You have to do this. Otherwise, nothing else will go well for you. And I took distance. I took time from doing this thing. And I came back to it recently. And I was like, wow, this isn't good for me. This is really bad. And it was really interesting because it took space. It took a forced distance from that thing to be able to have that perspective. And that really got me thinking about why that is. Like, how, I guess when you're in it all the time, you don't see how harmful something is. It's much like a shitty relationship where you're in it and you're so used to the abuse of it, to the not getting your needs met of it, to the fighting of it or whatever, that you don't really see the poison, the toxic crap that's in there until you forcibly take a break and forcibly make yourself go somewhere else. And then you come back and you're like, oh my God, what was I doing? What was I thinking? Anyways, I invite you to look at your lives and go, what am I doing? It's weird because this thing I was doing, this is a professional thing, by the way, I was doing this thing. I hated it. I just hated it. And I was so afraid to say no. I was so afraid of relinquishing doing this thing. Because if I said no to my agents, if I said no, I was so afraid that I would, you know, nothing else would come along. And this is how it's been done. And it's really interesting, man, because a lot of stuff has come because I've said no. It's almost like love, right? When you ignore somebody, they come after you. When you say no, they want it more. So yeah, I invite you. Look at your life. Look at your life. What are you enmeshed in? What are you so deep in, you don't even see how shitty it is? For some people, it could be a job. I remember when I would go to certain jobs and I would just be miserable. And, you know, I'd have gigs that you're supposed to love and I just hate it. But for some reason, your brain shuts off that part that goes, well, babe, why don't you leave? Why don't you do something else? It's like you can't admit to yourself that maybe doing something else would be a better thing for you, because something else is very scary. Change can be very, very very scary. So there's that. What else did I want to talk to you guys about? Oh, also with this kid stuff. I was watching Anthony Bourdain. There's a great He does that show Parts Unknown now on CNN. And it sucks. I don't like the theme song as much as I liked his other show's theme song. John Spencer, I think, does both. But this new one's like weird. I can't listen to the theme song. I really like Anthony Bourdain. I mean, I adore him. I love anybody that's been through catastrophic struggle and just through sheer force of will and hard work becomes a successful human being. You know, before he wrote Kitchen Confidential, which Oprah ended up picking up and loving, and, you know, he became a huge star. He wrote mystery novels. He wrote two failed mystery novels. And I thought that was really cool that he persisted despite his failures. And I hear he's a very hard worker, a workaholic. It sucks that he has to travel for these shows. I know he has a kid now and a new wife. That must suck. Can you believe it? And I see it sometimes on his new show. He just kind of phones it in. Like, at one point in the Budapest episode, he's like, I know you guys are like, you don't describe how the food tastes anymore. I mean, what am I supposed to say? It's got tastes. Like, he's so over it. He is so over it. And then that Andrew Zimmern kind of picked up his shtick. I think Anthony Bourdain was doing it long before, eating weird stuff on his show. Bourdain was eating crickets and, you know, weird stuff in China. And then that hack, Andrew Zimmern started doing a whole show. Could you imagine hosting that piece of shit show? You're like, hey, where am I going this week? Well, you're going to Bali. Ah, cool. What are you going to do? You're going to be eating eel dicks. Great. I would love to eat some more eel cock on this episode. What a nightmare to be just eating shitty food on a TV show. My God. My God. Hey, speaking of TV shows, you know I'm on the show How to Be a Grown-Up Tuesday nights, True TV. If you don't know that already, I talk about farting a lot. Me and my husband are on it. It's pretty cool. So anyway, I was going to talk about Anthony Bourdain going to Budapest. And it's such a great episode. If you do get a chance, watch this episode. For me, I cry every time I see anything about Hungary because of my parents' horrible, horrific childhoods in this country that was once a beautiful empire, was once the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And then World War I ravaged it. World War II ravaged Budapest. And then the communists came and ravaged the nation. So, you know, you're looking at, what, 100 years or plus of just dog shit life, of extreme poverty, of corruption, of just disaster, just complete disaster. And it really shined a light on my parents and their horrible lives and how much they tried to be normal with me, despite the level of suffering they had growing up. And there's this great part in this Anthony Bourdain show, Parts Unknown in Budapest, where he's interviewing this gypsy band. And there's like some famous gypsy lady singer. I don't know who she is, but anyway, he's interviewing her. And he's like, you know, so much about Hungarian culture is about suffering. Do you find that to be true? And she's like, oh, yes, everything is suffering. Everything is terrible. Basically agreeing with him that, like, well, yeah, I mean, Hungary's national, you know, export is misery. That's what we do. But we're also very talented, you know, cinematographers, violinists. I want to say a Hungarian helped do the Manhattan Project, which invented the atomic bomb. Penicillin, I believe, I want to say. I'm not sure. That might be a stretch for the Hungarians. My father loves to tell me which Hungarian did everything in history, but Tom Selleck, hey, that's one my dad loves to tell me. You know Tom Selleck, his real name is Tom Selleckach. It's short for Selleckach. Yeah, Tom Selleck's a Hungarian. I'm sure Tom Selleck is thrilled to be Hungarian. But I was watching this, and, you know, I spend a lot of time shitting on my parents on this podcast. But in light of me soon to be becoming a mom, I've really been watching how other people, Americans specifically, parent their kids. And as much as I love this country and I love so much of it, some of this American shit I don't really get. And I'm starting to appreciate some of my European upbringing, you know, little stuff like children are expected to say hello to adults when they enter your home. It's not cool for a kid to just run into your house and plunk down in front of your TV and ignore you, you know? I'm not saying that all American kids do that. I'm sure they're completely, perfectly mannered American children, but I've seen the opposite too. And I don't know. Maybe I'm being judgmental, but the point of the story is I liked certain parts of my upbringing. I like that I know how to eat with a fork and knife, Euro style, which is you keep the fork in your left hand. You don't switch it over to your right when you bring the food to your mouth. And it makes me goddamn crazy when I go to a restaurant and I see adults who don't know how to use a fork and a knife. I go crazy because that's like the first thing they teach you as a European kid. You learn how to eat with a fork and a knife because that's one of the marks of a civil human being. You animals, learn how to do that. I grew up with some cool stuff. Okay, like we didn't watch TV during dinner. A self-reliant, maybe too self-reliant as I was as a kid, I did enjoy that my parents treated me as a human, as a little human capable of behaving. If we go out to like an adult party, I was just expected to behave. The children did what the adults did. It wasn't the other way around. I think now it's the other way around. The kid's the center of the universe. And, you know, everyone's got to stop what they're doing and listen to what the fucking kid's doing. And that makes me bonkers. I mean, I was having dinner with about 8 adults. This is like a year ago at someone's house. And there's a 3-year-old at the table. And we were all trying to have adult conversation. But the kid was ruling, dominating the space. And that's fine if it happens like, oh, you know, maybe the kid's freaking out. Let's address it. But no. And the mother insisted on it being brought back to what the 3-year-old was doing and saying. I was like, you got to be shitting me that we're all trying to have a conversation and none of us can, you know, and that just didn't happen in my culture. Like it just didn't happen, bro. Like if you wanted your parents' attention, it was, can you wait a second? All you got to do is be like, wait 5 minutes until mom and dad can come and help you. Or in my case, mom or dad. Come on, let's be real. It wasn't mom and dad at the same time. But yeah, there is the feeling in my home that I could handle, waiting for a few seconds or not being catered to, maybe to a deficit. All right. Cause let's be honest. I spent a lot of time in my room hiding from my parents, a lot of time alone, guys. That's why I'm sitting alone in a room now talking into a microphone. So anyway, I came to the conclusion that my, childhood, although flawed, had some good things. And my therapist said that's a big breakthrough for me to be able to acknowledge that they weren't all terrible. It does feel like a big one, doesn't it? Okay. You're saying to me, Christina, where's the goddamn philosophy? I'm sorry. I just feel like I have so much to share with you on a personal level. I wanted to address it in a nice way. I didn't want to just be like, I'm pregnant. Let's talk about shame, everybody. I wanted to kind of let my feelings marinate and my thoughts. And what a roller coaster. Okay, so now here's the meat of it. Here's the crux of it. Mom role too. Yeah. So as you know, I've delayed having children for many years because of my relationship to my own mother, my absolute fear and terror of parenting like my mother. For those of you who don't know my background, my mother is a mental patient. She started off as a borderline personality disorder and has descended into full schizophrenia. And as a little kid, I didn't know that. As a little kid, I just grew up with this mom who, had some weird rules in the house. And I just adapted to what I knew. Speaking of just, you have to survive. You kind of adapt to go on. You don't see any other way of doing it. And I was a kid, so I had to go along with the program. But so the point is, I've since dealt with my mommy issues. I've been in therapy for the last six years, And it's been fantastic. Like, I can't recommend psychotherapy, whatever therapy, enough. If you're dealing with anxiety, if you have anxiety for no reason, depression, all this stuff that's consistent, chances are you've got an issue that needs to be addressed. Please go see a therapist. I don't know why it's got this weird stigma, like you're incapable or something if you see a therapist. It's so stupid. I don't know why. I mean, if your leg was broken, you'd see a doctor. Something's wrong with your psyche. It's broken. Go see a shrink. But see a good one. There's a lot of shitty ones out there. Be selective. If you don't like somebody, go see somebody else. Find the right one that's a match for you, because this lady's great for me, the one that I see. But anyways, I digress. Brings me to the point. So my mother, I have a very strained relationship. I don't have a relationship with her now. I haven't spoken to her for 6 years with good reason. Not only is she incapable of human relationships, she's also actively harmful. Okay, so she's not a great, just she makes bad decisions. She's a bit of an evildoer, as George Bush would say. She actively sought to ruin my life many times over, and I can't have her. It can't happen, guys. I can't have her in my life. And it's been great to have some distance, as I was talking about earlier. Distance, perspective, gives you a moment to look back and go, wow, that was crazy. So I was going, my husband and I were going to move our office. We currently do our show out of our home, but we're going to now move it into a proper office. And we're going through boxes of crap that we have. And I found a letter from my mother from 2004. And it was typed. There were parts that were handwritten. There were parts that were highlighted. There are some pictures she'd drawn. It was a lot. And I read it, and you know, my immediate brain went, whoa, this is cray cray, because the content was like, it was just all over the place. Like, I saw you on, by the time I was on MySpace, I saw you on MySpace, be safe, be careful, everybody knows, but don't email me, because email's not safe. Like, it was just, it was gobbledygook. And I read it once, and then I read it a second time, and I went, oh, I know what she means. I get it. And I handed the letter to my husband, and he read it, and he went, wow. Hey, you know your mom's, like, crazy, right? He's like, you know that this is crazy talk on a letter. And I had two sides of my brain. One side that went, yeah, of clearly this person is not well. This is a letter kind of written by somebody. None of it, every line didn't make sense to the thing that she said before it. And there was a lot of paranoia. There's a lot of, like, don't call me because it's not safe. Don't email me. It's not safe. Like, a lot of crazy shit in there. And then my, like, other side of my brain, the dysfunctional side, kicked in and went, oh, but I understand what this means. Because I did, because I grew up speaking the same language as a mentally, she taught me basically how to understand what she meant. I spoke a dysfunctional language, which is like, whoa, like, I could read that letter and I knew exactly what she was trying to say. That was her way of saying, I love you, you know, be careful. You know, your stepfather's an asshole who monitors what I do, which he never did. But anyways, it really, really brought me into thinking about language, about meaning, and about how the hell do we understand one another. It's really a miracle that anybody understands anybody else. I get misunderstood a lot. I think as a comedian, my aim is to never, I don't aim to ever upset people. I don't aim to hurt anybody's feelings. That's not the point. But I do aim to be thought-provoking, to be, I don't know, just to have fun and to point out crap. And sometimes people get too upset and I get emails and I hate it. I hate that part because that's not my intent. But language is complicated. And I thought I would bring up Jacques Derrida. Jacques Derrida is one of those sexy philosophers that I absolutely love, because, you know, the sexy philosophers, you got your Foucaults, your Jean-Paul Sartres, You know, Friedrich Nietzsche is kind of a sexy philosopher, and Jacques Derrida was one of these celebrity philosopher types in the 1960s, obviously French. Shitty childhood. Pretty sure he was born in like Algeria somewhere and poor and couldn't go to school for a few years. Like just whatever. He ends up becoming a teacher and like writing about something called deconstruction. And most people, most scholars poo-poo deconstruction and be like, this is stupid, dude. What are you talking about, you lunatic? But like Americans, we love novelty. We love excitement. And it's a sexy philosophy. And I think like Yale people picked up deconstruction and kind of ran with it. And you had this cult-like following of Derrida. And I read a book of his in college. And, you know, I hope I'm understanding it properly. I think it was called, hold on, Between the Margins. Let me make sure I'm getting that title right, because I hate giving wrong titles on this show. God forbid. No, I was wrong. It's called Margins of Philosophy, Jacques Derrida. There's also a documentary about him, I think, if it's still on Netflix. It's very cute. He's very French. I remember a part where he's eating his little eggplant, his little lunch of eggplant. Very esoteric crap. Very esoteric stuff. If anything, I wouldn't consider Derrida to be a rigorous analytic philosopher by any means. He's more of a thought provoker. He's more of a guy who kind of points stuff out and you go, huh, that's interesting. Now what? You know, now where do we go? And I don't know if he necessarily has the right answer to that either, but at any rate, he really contributed to postmodernism, to the idea of looking at texts differently, the idea of meta narratives and what does stuff really mean. And this is a very cursory look at Jacques Derrida. If this interests you, by all means, please check out, the rest of his stuff. But so here he goes, Derrida. In a nutshell, God help me. I mean, I'm not even sure if I remember anything. Here we go. So, as you know, the aim of philosophy is to get to truth with a capital T. What the hell does that mean? I didn't even understand what that meant for several years. I think what it means is to get at the ultimate reality of stuff. Philosophy always seeks to get to the ultimate reality of reality. And, you know, there's always been a way of like, do we kind of intuit that stuff? Do we remember stuff? Is it inherently in us and we remember things and that's truth? Do we put things together abstractly? Are there forms of things? That's what Plato thought. There are forms of things, and then there's copies of the form of the thing that exists. And it's so crazy. Anyways, philosophy aims at the truth. And mathematics for a long time was used as proof that there is such a thing as absolute knowledge. There is such a thing as absolute truth. And mathematics was thought to be that level of truth. So mathematics is the one thing we know for certain. And Husserl, remember that guy, phenomenology? Oh boy. Husserl uses geometry. So anyway, Derrida was huge into Husserl. He uses geometry to say that, for instance, 2 + 2 = 4. That's supposed to be a certainty. Husserl says we intuit the premises for geometry. Then we use deductive reasoning from those intuitions. And then we base geometric principles on that. So in other words, knowledge starts with intuitions, like the thing exists somewhere in the ethers, right? Geometry exists out there in the extramental world. We intuit somehow the basis for these things. And then once we use our intuition, we use then deductive reasoning to come up with a geometric system. Oh boy, right? So Derrida goes, well, hey, bro, which one is it? Are we intuiting or are we deducing? Those are two different types of reasoning in philosophy. There's intuitive reasoning and deducing, deductive reasoning. Derrida says, you can't have it both ways, bro. And P.S., did you hear my lisp? P.S., math isn't absolute. And he uses George Barclay's, is it George? It's not Charles Barclay. Charles is the football player. George Barclay's argument that that there are inconsistencies in mathematics. And, you know, Berkeley references some kind of mathematical proof that is logically inconsistent. I never understood it, so I'm not going to reference it here. But he thought philosophy to be inherently contradictory, or a priori is what they say. It's in full of inherent contradictions. Our notion of knowledge is inconsistent. How do you know stuff intuitively? How do you deduce stuff? Anyway, language, that was his big thing, is language. Language has different meanings, and philosophy relies on language to make its deductive reasoning or whatever, inductive reasonings. Philosophy is looking for the essence behind things, the truth, but language is limited, right? When we express these essence, we want to get to the essence, the truth of things, but language in and of itself is very limited. And philosophy is based on introducing binaries or opposites, right? There's positive, there's negative, there's good, there's evil, there's mind, there's the body. And the terms don't really describe what the essence of something is so much as they describe the differences between these two terms. And that's, I think, what Derrida is trying to say. We'll never get at some Platonic ideal. We'll never get to the world of forms that Plato described, these essences of realities, because language is so limited and it's so relative in its meaning. That's how we do language. We do it in relative meanings. He references the Phaedrus, I think, of Plato, where he takes a word, I don't know, but let's say it's fart in this argument. He goes, well, in France, fart means this, but in here it means this. So even in terms of everyday reading fiction, words mean different things. And I always kind of agreed with this idea, especially when you're reading this crap in school, when the teacher would tell you what something means, like if you'd be reading Edgar Allan Poe, she's like, well, that's what this means, this symbolism. And you're like, well, how do you know that, bitch? I always thought it was funny that they could tell me what the author's intent was on any given story. It just seemed crazy. So philosophy, much like psychoanalysis, I think he adapts psychoanalysis, is that people also put meaning into words that don't necessarily exist, or that you're putting your own consciousness onto words. So language is contextual, and there's subtext to everything. I mean, if you look at foreign speakers of any language, they don't know the exact meaning of words the way you do. It's a goddamn miracle that we communicate with one another at all, if you ask me. Difference, that's Jacques Derrida's big thing, the difference that words have multiple meanings. And basically, like I said, there's really no like system that he wants to put into place. It's more of like, hey, here's something I thought of. And I think that's how he's been received in the philosophy world, is more of like this guy that came up with deconstruction. Let's deconstruct the text. That's what he was always saying, right? Deconstruct fiction. Let's look at it through difference, meaning. you know, in the book Margins of Philosophy, it's even printed with the margins messed up so that you kind of get to see what he's saying. You fill in the gaps with your own mind and all this crap. Very exciting philosophy. A little annoying, I think, but thought-provoking nonetheless. Pretty interesting shit. It's pretty deep, bro. You know, it's really esoteric, but I love the idea that you kind of imprint your own meaning on stuff, which brought me back to my mother's letter. And how is it that I could understand something a few years ago so much, and with just a little bit of space and a little bit of distance and time, it became completely different for me? It's really, really interesting. And yeah. Anyways, that's it. That's been my week. I invite you to examine the things in your life from a distance. Give something some space that maybe you feel inherently needs some space. Maybe you're afraid to give space to. Do it anyways. See what happens. See if you can find within the margins what's going on there. What's the subtext? What's the meaning? Where's the difference? Take some space. Because believe me, it's kind of a mind blower. That was kind of a mind blowing thing to read my mother's letter many, many years later, and to understand it and to not understand the words at the same time. Very, very interesting stuff. So there you go, guys. That's been Deep Bro. Thank you so much for listening. Please send me your emails. I adore them. That's deepbropodcast@gmail.com. And I'm so glad to finally tell you I'm preggers. Send me your emails. All right, guys. Have a great week. Bye.
Now what? I don't know. Philosophize with.
It's Christina P, a.k.a. Miss Jeans. This ain't your mom's house. It's a different theme. Gotta be critically thinking. Like you caught up at a cocktail party. Our thoughts start to sink in. John Locke, or was it Socrates? Aristotle or Plato, maybe Hippocrates. Got us talking all properly, topically. Just a comedian discussing these philosophies. Serious questions, silly people. What's that? That's deep, bro.
It is the ultimate metaphor for life. And you know what that is?
What?
That's deep, bro.